Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com. The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, that inflation just keeps going higher and higher, doesn't it? According to the latest data out this week, the Consumer Price Index climbed 9.1% in June, the most in almost 41 years. And now markets are pricing in an even more aggressive response from the Federal Reserve to tame surging prices with interest rate hikes. But is triggering a recession the only way the Fed can tame inflation? Well, we'll get into it with a very well-known economist who, by the way, Valdana, is from my hometown of Westchester, PA. I'm very excited.
I am too.
But Valdana, I also had to ask you, I keep reading about these problems with airlines and everyone's flight being delayed. I think it's all your fault.
I was about to say, you're about to blame me.
It's all your fault.
For all the problems.
Every week you're off to another exotic location.
I did go to Florida last week.
Did you clog up the airlines?
No, I flew from the Trenton Airport.
The Trenton, New Jersey.
I really shouldn't be publicizing this because I want to keep it a secret. It was so easy to get in, and it literally took 2 minutes to get off the plane. Like, no, there were no people there. It was the easiest process in the world.
From the Trenton, New Jersey airport, which I know well from my days in Trenton. Did they serve, like, pork roll on the flight?
No, that actually would be really
mustard
smart
pie?
Of them. No, but it's like, my parents live really close to it. I went with my parents to Florida. It was the easiest process and the best flight. Like, so easy.
That's good to know.
I should not be advertising it. But possibly our guest, who actually, I think, lives close by to Trenton as well. He might be utilizing this airport.
We'll
now,
see.
Now
we'll
that I've talked it up so much. But I want to welcome Mark Zandi. He's the chief economist for Moody's Analytics, and he's the host of the Inside Economics podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be with you. I had no idea you could fly from Trenton. Where in Florida did you fly to?
So you can fly to, I flew to Fort Lauderdale. I hung out with our old colleague, Sarah Ponczak, actually, Mike.
Oh, how about that?
And who she lives in Fort Lauderdale now. And it was just the easiest process. It was honestly like, I'm never going to New York again.
I was
going
to say, Bart, you can only fly from Trenton to Camden is the downside.
Yeah.
That's it. But you can. It's very smooth flying.
Yeah, it was
that's
really
good
great.
To know. Yeah, I had to check that out. I have a home in Vero, which is just up the coast from Fort Lauderdale. So,
you got to do it. It was so
I got to check that out. And the tickets were okay priced.
Oh, they were so cheap. I don't even want to tell you.
Yeah. Okay. All right, very good.
I'm really talking this up. You're going to go and have a bad experience.
I'm definitely checking
my fault.
It out. And Mike, I should ask you, what high school did you go to?
Bishop Shanahan High School. When it was still in the borough of Westchester, now they've
good
built,
Catholic boy, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You try. I try. You know. Yeah.
You look tall. Did you play basketball?
My reputation precedes me. I did indeed play basketball. JV, you know.
Well, you know, basketball is basketball.
Yeah. And we had a good squad back then. We were state champions in like 1985. I did not play on the state champions.
He wasn't
team,
on that. He yeah, was on the team in like the 30s or something.
Well, Donna, come back and make fun of Mike. But I, you know, it sounds like she's
enough abuse of me. I feel like, yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. We've reached our limit on that.
Yeah. No, I think there's more to go. So, Mark, I want to start with the CPI print, which we got this week. And then I saw you actually tweet about it. You said it was predictably ugly and that it might take 18 to 24 months for us to get back down to 2%. Another thing you said was that rent growth will be an impediment. There's a shortage of affordable homes. So can you talk to us about what we got this week and what you're forecasting?
Yeah, right. 9.1% year-over-year CPI inflation through the month of June. Here's an interesting factoid. I mean, I think it strikes the point home. The average or the typical American household who makes about $60K a year, they need to spend almost $500 more a month to buy the same goods and services that they were purchasing a year ago. So just think about that for a second. I mean, that's pretty painful. And, you know, there's no way around the high inflation. I mean, you know, particularly gasoline prices. I mean, you got to go to work, you got to go grocery shopping, you got to go to school. So no way around that. Rents are up a lot, given the affordable housing shortage. Food prices are up. A lot of that goes back to energy because of diesel prices, you know, getting the things, the food from from the farm to the store shelf. But everything's up a lot. Yeah, very few. In fact, I was looking through the report for things that have fallen in price. And I can count them on one hand, really. And like smartphones are down, and that's because of improvement in technology. Men's pants, believe it or not, they're selling for less today than a year ago. I'm in my shorts right now, so maybe.
I was going to say, sweatpants are up. Sweatpants have doubled in price.
Actually, now that I think about it, how many pairs of pants have I bought in the last year? I can't tell you. I don't think I have. Yeah. Anyway, so prices are up a lot, and it's really hurting. I'll just tease it, and I'll stop. But I do think that will be the worst of it. I say that with intrepidation because I've said that before in the last few months. Because, you know, pegging the peak in inflation is intrepid because it depends on oil prices and gasoline prices, which goes back to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and sanctions and the timing of sanctions. Hard to get that right, but it feels like we're moving on the right side of the inflation picture now. I mean, long way to get back, as I said, 18 to 24 months to something we all feel comfortable with, but I think we're on our way, and fingers crossed.
You know, the one weird thing I've noticed, Mark, with people trying to call the peak in inflation is that it's such a moving target as far as what's driving it. I mean, obviously, energy, oil, gasoline prices. But, you know, last year, everyone was looking at lumber. When lumber prices peaked, they thought, oh, that's it. That's the sign that inflation has peaked. Now I have to wonder about rent, owner's equivalent rent in the CPI report. And I had talked to Rob Arnott a few months ago of Research Affiliates, and he was sort of very hawkish about inflation because he said, look, home prices have risen something like 30-some% since the end of 2019. And is in his thinking, that has to trickle into owner's equivalent rent or the other shelter components of CPI. So even if oil energy comes off the boil, how big of a deal is rent going to be going forward, do you think? I mean, is there still some of that home price appreciation, as Arnott predicts, that has to trickle into the rent component of CPI?
Yeah, reasonable. I mean, just to give a set of numbers to make it concrete. I mean, let's say inflation we know now is 9.1. If oil prices simply go flat, and that means gasoline prices will come down a bit, diesel prices will come in a bit, jet fuel, because we've been paying a lot more for airfare, except if you fly from Trenton, apparently, you know, you've been paying more for airfares. That'll take about half the inflation away. So you go from 9 to, you know, 4.5, 5, you know, something like that. And that getting from 5 to 2.5, which is kind of the upper end of the Fed's target for CPI inflation, that's going to be much more difficult because that goes to some supply chain, products that have been disrupted by supply chain issues like vehicle prices. But the big chunk of that is, in fact, the higher rent rents that we're now paying and the very strong rent growth, which is actually the market rents have been rising now for more than a year, double digit, but it's only now getting into the, because of measurement methodologies by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only now getting into the CPI for rent in a fulsome way. I will say, though, that it feels like market rents growth has topped out, that it is starting to roll over. And that goes to the fact, I think, a couple of things. One is renters just can't afford these rents. You know, they're balking and they're going to double up or triple up, go back to their parents' house. You're not going to see households form because, you know, kids can't afford and households can't afford these rents. So that's starting to, I think, affect the ability of landlords to increase their rent growth. And more supply is coming. You know, we're actually putting up a lot of multifamily units by historical standards, and a lot more is in train. In fact, there's a record number of units, multifamily units in the pipeline going towards completion. They've been delayed because of the pandemic and the supply chain issues, which have, go back to your point about lumber, you know, it's disrupted all kinds of building materials and it's affected labor markets. So construction workers builders have been having trouble finding construction workers in some parts of the country. But as that gets ironed out, I think rent growth will roll over even further. It'll remain high, you know, kind of high, mid-high single digit year-over-year growth, but it's going to start to come in. And once that does, by this time next year, rent growth will become less additive to inflation. It will become still add, but less additive. And I think it'll allow inflation broadly to moderate back down close to the Federal Reserve's target. But again, it's going to take a while to get there.
What about all the other pieces of inflation besides housing? Because, you know, you have this projection about the next 18 to 24 months. What else is going to be happening over the next 18 to 24 months? I know you have downgraded your GDP outlook for this year and next, right?
I have. Still no recession. Obviously, recession risks are high, and we could talk about that. I mean, I clearly, when inflation is so high and the Fed is on DEFCON 1 and really rightfully focused on getting that inflation down by jacking up interest rates, and sentiment is miserable, right? I mean, I talk to CEOs, CFOs, investors, you know, friends, family, to the person, they think we're going into recession. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, you can look at my hairline. I've seen a lot of business cycles now, and no one predicts recessions, but in this one, everyone is predicting a recession. So when sentiment is so fragile, it's not going to take a whole lot to push us in. I think with a little bit of luck, we can talk about what that means, and some reasonably good policymaking by the Fed, and we can talk about what that means, we're going to be able to avoid a recession. But I don't say that with a lot of confidence. I think that's, you know, recession risks are very high. But I don't think we need a recession to get, you know, inflation back in. You know, oil prices are going to roll over. Natural gas prices are going to fall. We're going to see vehicle prices come down as supply chain issues iron themselves out and we get more vehicle production. Commodity prices, goods prices more broadly are going to come in. Again, with a little bit of luck and some reasonably deft policy making by the Fed, we should be able to navigate through. But, you know, obviously, it's going to be a close call.
Well, it's funny, Mark, because there's once again, there's this debate about what exactly is the definition of a recession. You know, if you boil it down to the most simplest form, people tend to say, well, 2 quarters of negative GDP growth, which we might actually get for the first half of this year. But then everyone else says, well, no, the National Bureau of Economic Researchers, they're the ones who decide if it's a recession, but they have a long list of other items. Are you pretty comfortable in sort of wrapping your head around what it takes for the NBER to declare a recession? Or is there some wiggle room there? Is there some sort of qualitative element to it that would allow them to say, yeah, this one doesn't count? You know, especially, Mark, when you think of this job market, we still have 11 million job openings in this country.
Yeah.
You know, is it, you know, 2 quarters of negative growth?
That's a rule of thumb.
Yeah. Mike. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's worked in the past. It correlates very well with the decisions by the academics sitting on the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. But, you know, GDP is like one thing they look at. And I don't even think it's at the top of the list of things that they look at. I mean, it's employment, it's income less transfer payments, it's manufacturing and trade sales. There's a lot of different indicators that they look at to gauge what, you know, whether this feels like a recession. And by the way, the way they define a recession, I think it's right, and I'm going to paraphrase, so I don't have the wording exactly right, but you'll get the gist of it. It's a broad-based, persistent decline in economic activity. Lots of wiggle room there in that definition.
Right.
So no, I don't. What we've experienced the first half of the year is that is not a recession. I mean, can't create. We're creating what we created 400,000 or 500,000 jobs on average per month in the first half of the year. And I think the if you look at layoffs, you know, as measured by a claims for unemployment insurance, I think that's at a record low in the first half of the year. I mean, it's just that's not a recession, and I don't think they'll call it one. Not that, you know, a recession isn't dead ahead. That, you know, obviously there's a lot of risk, but that, what we've experienced so far, that's not a recession. And here's an intrepid forecast for you. You'll have to ask me back, you know, 5 years from now. But once we get all the GDP revisions in. And GDP gets revised, you know, it's an imprecise representation of reality, like most data. But once it gets, you know, revised with all of the data that comes available, my guess is these declines could get completely Q1, that decline may not get completely revised away. But Q2, if we get a small decline, I'm guessing that gets revised away. I just don't think it's accurately representing what's going on. And there's a lot of reasons to suspect that, given that the pandemic has created havoc with, you know, all the different economic statistics that we look at.
Yeah, I also wonder, Mark, does it really matter whether recession dating committee says, yes, it's a recession, no, it's not? You know, what difference does it really make?
Well, obviously it makes a political difference.
Besides that, though, it's, you know, is the trying to think, is there some bond covenant somewhere that's triggered, you know, anything like that? I'm at a loss for, you know, if whether there's a material distinction between, well, it feels like a recession and someone, you know, rubber stamping it and saying, yes, this is technically a recession. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, policy probably, you know, policy. Probably so if they come out, if the business cycle dating committee came out and said recession started in January, you know, that might light a fire under policymakers, and they say, oh, you know, maybe we need to do X, Y, and Z. So it might have some impact there. There are some, interestingly enough, that you bring it up, there's efforts to codify where we are in the business cycle for different types of economic policy. So, you know, for example, if unemployment rises by a certain amount over a certain period of time, then you automatically trigger, you know, supplemental unemployment insurance benefits or some other form of benefit. You know, we have these automatic, what do we call automatic stabilizers in the federal budget, things that help the economy out when it's not doing well. But you could reinforce those automatic stabilizers by, you know, pegging to recession dates or something like that. But that's not the case now, but you're right. I mean, you're right. Whether the recession began in March or April or May, you're right. I don't know that it matters a whole lot to in the grand scheme of things.
So Mark, when you downgraded your GDP growth outlook, I think you said odds remain that the economic expansion will continue. And I wanted to ask you what specifically you were thinking there. Was it the jobs figures we were just talking about, or what goes into that thought?
Well, a bunch of stuff, but I'll name one thing. The thing that I take the most solace in is that, in my mind, the firewall between a continuing growing economy and a recession is the American consumer. The American consumer hangs tough. Just do their part, you know, spend like they've always been spending. We'll avoid a recession. And by the way, if the American consumer hangs tough, they'll keep the global economy moving forward as well. You know, some parts of the global economy will go in, but you know, the U.S. consumer is kind of driving the train right now. And if you look at the American consumer, in pretty good shape. I mean, obviously, they're getting hammered by the high inflation right now. But, you know, they got a lot of excess saving they built up during the pandemic. And it's across all income groups. For the typical American household, by my calculation, they, as of June, had $7,000-$8,000 in excess savings. So if I'm paying $500 more a month for the higher inflation, and I have $7,000-$8,000 in excess saving, you can do the arithmetic. That buys me a little bit of time, right? I can use that excess saving to supplement my income to compensate, to offset the ill effects of the high inflation. Debt is low. Debt service burdens are about as low as they've ever been. Debt service is what share of people's income is going to servicing their debt, interest payments, principal payments. That's pretty close to a record low. people have locked in the previously low record interest rates through refinancing ways. So they're very insulated from the higher rates. You know, stock prices are down, but house prices are up. People are wealthier today, particularly middle American households are more wealthy today than they were a year ago, and a lot more wealthy than they were 3 or 5, 10 years ago. So I can go on, but that just gives me a sense that the consumers are going to, they're going to hang tough, and they're going to continue and just not, they're not going to spend with abandon. They haven't been doing that, but if they just simply spend at a rate that they have consistently done in recent history, pre-pandemic, and up and through the pandemic, I think we should be able to get through this without, you know, going into a full-blown recession. So number that's at the very top of the tippity top of reasons why, you know, I'm still sanguine. I say that with intrepidation. I don't want to sound Pollyannish. Obviously, my recession odds are pretty high, uncomfortably high. But nonetheless, that gives me some confidence that, you know, again, with a little bit of luck on the pandemic and the Russian invasion and some deft policymaking, we can make our way through without an actual recession.
Yeah, I think you're, from the note I read, your recession probability is like 40% in the next 12 months, 50% in the next 24 months. That is, yep. You know, if you look at like a recession probability index, that's alarmingly high, you know,
yeah.
When they get that
yeah,
high.
I mean, I'm very, I go back to the sentiment. It's just very, very dark. Consumers, you saw the small business survey from the National Federation of Independent Business. I think that hit a kind of an all-time lower, pretty close, lower than even in the teeth of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's very low. I don't know if it hit the record, but yeah.
Yeah. How are you guys feeling?
It's the vibes recession, Vildana, I think.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, I like that.
Have you heard that?
I love it.
Vibes recession.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Mark, I wanted to get back to that. You touched on the home price, this amazing acceleration in home prices we've seen over the last 2 years. Obviously, everyone I've talked to says, well, should housing cool off, the financial system's on much better footing than it was in the days of subprime liar loans and whatnot, and this, you know, structured finance that got out of control in the mortgage market. But I can't help but wonder if we are in for a pretty nasty cooling off of the housing market. And given its importance, to your point, to sort of household net worth, to the labor market when you're talking about new home construction, to the retail market when you're talking about people buying and selling homes and doing home improvement projects, it's just such an important component of the economy. What does housing look like to you in the next year or two? And sort of what are the potential ripple effects of it potentially cooling off on the rest of the economy?
Oh, no, Mike, it's cooling off. It's going into deep freeze pretty fast here. Mortgage rates at just north of or just south of 6%, almost double what they were a year ago at their all-time low. And you just take that higher interest rate, you multiply by the higher house price, and you look at the monthly payment that a first-time home buyer is facing. It's, you know, $500, $600 more now than it was a year ago. That's prohibitive. So first-time home buyers are locked out of the market. And trade-up buyers are kind of locked in, right? Because the average rate on outstanding mortgages, given all that refinancing I talked about earlier, is 3.5% to 4%. So if you sell your home and buy another one and get a mortgage, you're going from 3.5, 4 to 6. That's a big increase in payment. So people just aren't going to do that. So you're seeing home sales come down dramatically, you know, already. And listings are starting to improve. I mean, I follow different markets across the country, and I could, you know, I get listings emailed to me, and I can just feel it. I can just see the list of, I mean, if I go back, you know, 6 months ago, there was nothing, no inventory, but now the list is getting longer and longer and longer. And I expect house prices in parts of the country to fall, particularly in the areas where prices have been juiced the most, you know, in the pandemic, in the Southeast, in Florida, you know, except my home in Vero, that should be fine. That's no problem.
It's always Florida for some reason.
It's always Florida. You know, the Mountain West, you can draw a line. I now know how to pronounce Boise, if you're wondering. Boise down to Phoenix, you can draw a line and go a few hundred miles on either side. So I expect some price declines there. Nationwide, we might be able to sneak through with prices just essentially going flat here for a couple, 3 years and let household incomes and rents and construction costs kind of catch up. But that assumes no recession. If we get into a recession, then I think that's going to put real downward weight on house price, and we'll see some national house price declines. But I'll say two other things about this. One, this is by design, right? The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to slow growth, and that happens through the most rate-sensitive sectors of the economy. Housing is the single most interest rate-sensitive sector of the economy. So this is not, you know, a big surprise. It is exactly what you would expect. And second, I don't expect the prices to crash because the mortgage lending that's been done since the financial crisis and the collapse in housing back over a decade ago has been fat. I'm on the board of directors of, I should disclose this, of MGIC, a nationwide publicly traded mortgage insurer. And I'm on the chair of the risk committee. So I look at underwriting very carefully. And, you know, it's been pristine since the collapse. And the other thing is, it's all plain vanilla, you know, 30-year, 15-year, fixed rate, prepayable mortgages, nothing fancy, no adjustable rate, right. 2 year subprime adjust. So I just don't see the stresses here to result in a, you know, big sharp decline in prices. But, you know, prices going flat nationwide and down in a fair share of markets. Yeah, I would anticipate that. And I would say that's exactly what the Fed wants to see.
Well, actually, Mark, I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit more about that. Like, which areas are the most at risk across the country? I know you had said recently that from coast to coast, we'll be seeing housing prices coming down. Overall, what is the downside risk for housing? How bad can things get, and where specifically?
Yeah, no recession. I think national prices, the house prices effectively go flat here over the next 2, 3, maybe 4 years. That means big parts of the country are going to experience meaningful price declines. So in the most juiced markets where I expect the biggest price corrections because of affordability, primarily because of affordability, that would be in the Southeast and in the West. So the poster child would probably be, you know, like a Charlotte, North Carolina, a Tampa, Florida, you know, a Phoenix, Arizona, a Boise, Idaho. And it's it fundamentally goes to affordability, right? Because prices have risen so far, so fast in these markets, and you add in these higher mortgage rates, and you just simply, people just simply can't afford to buy the home. It doesn't make, you know, they just can't come up with the monthly payment that they need. And so that means prices have to come in. Now, I will say it may take a bit of time for prices to come in because people have in their minds what they think their home is worth. You know, in real estate, at turning points like this, the sellers and buyers go into kind of like a kabuki dance trying to figure out what real value is. And that takes a little bit of time. Transactions stop. That's why I think home sales are going to be getting crushed and why they're going to be weak. But it takes a little bit of time for them to figure out value, price, transact, and for that to show up in the data. So it may take, you know, 6, 12, 18 months before this all shows up. The other thing I throw into the mix is in some of these most juiced markets, we have seen more flipping going on, which is not surprising. Flipping meaning investors that come in and buy a property with the intent of selling it rapidly. You know, the iBuyer, for example, would be kind of an institutional flipper. And they have infected some markets, like a Phoenix is the best example of that. Raleigh, Charlotte, Atlanta, those Florida markets again. And as a result, you know, they'll get wrung out, and that means you'll see bigger price declines in those parts of the country.
But Mark, you know, I know you're primarily focused on the U.S., so this might be a little bit of a curveball, but
no, Mike, my remit's, you know, pretty wide. Not that I'll give you my 3 cents about almost anything. So fire away.
All right, good. Well, 3 euro cents, which is parity.
Oh, okay.
Is parity,
yeah,
these days. So
yeah.
But I can't help but think about temperatures getting cooler in Europe and the Russia tension escalating and the possibility of the gas getting turned off, or at least threatened to be turned off. A lot of people are talking about that these days. I know for someone like you who, you know, is based in data and history and all that, it's got to be tough to sort of all of a sudden incorporate a Vladimir Putin type of character into your, you know, how you're thinking about the future. But how big of a risk is that? Some sort of, you know, escalation of tensions between Russia and Europe that causes an even bigger energy crisis there? And what are the sort of global spillover risks of that? I mean, obviously, I'm guessing they're pretty bad all around, but how are you thinking about sort of the fall and winter and Europe and this conflict really showing no signs of abating?
Yeah, good point. And by the way, just because you made reference to this earlier, you know, the reason why, in my view, economists got, including me, inflation wrong is we got the pandemic wrong, and Russia wasn't even on the radar screen, you know, this time last year, right? So, and when I say the pandemic, we got the vaccines a little over a year ago. You remember President Biden say, go enjoy your families on July 4th. We thought the pandemic was behind us, but Delta was literally already a problem and created all kinds of havoc, and particularly in Asia where the supply chains begin. So the surprise isn't inflation per se. The surprise was just the pandemic and of course, what Putin has done in Russia, which has been, you know, incredibly debilitating, you know, to the global economy, and really a problem for Europe, because they depend so much, Europeans, continental Europeans in particular, on Russian energy. You know, there's a lot of other links, agriculture and metals and technology and all kinds of things. But, you know, the energy has been very, very significant. It's not just oil, but even more importantly is natural gas for some of these countries. I think I got this right, Germany gets 40% of its natural gas from Russia. And they really rely on the natural gas for not only home heating, but for their industry. And, you know, for Germany, that's a locomotive for the EU economy. And a lot of it is industry. It's the vehicle industry, for example, that really relies on that really drives the train. And you know, obviously they're really struggling with this. So I do worry about that. And there's a lot of script to be written here, right? I mean, the EU, the European Union, sanctioned Russian oil back in early June. By the way, that's why oil prices went skyward and gas prices hit their record high in June. And that's what we're seeing in today's, in this week's CPI report, you know, this week's CPI report. But I do worry that, you know, going forward that they actually implement the sanctions and stop buying. Right now they said they're going to sanction, but they're still buying the oil. So it's oil still getting into the marketplace. But what happens if they actually stop buying the oil, or the Russians turn it off? Oil prices will go right back up again, and that'll, you know, obviously create a lot of problems. Or what if the Russians turn off that natural gas? You know, that they don't just stop pumping natural gas and shipping it through the pipelines to Germany, and that would send the European economy, you know, deeply in recession. So, I think that's a real significant. Obviously, Europe is it. If our recession risks are high, theirs are. I'd be surprised if they're able to avoid recession. It's going to be very, very difficult. And that does reverberate back on us. Now, fortunately, the U.S. economy remains quite insulated. You know, we have globalized, but when you do the arithmetic, we still are mostly a domestically driven economy, consumers and U.S. businesses driving growth. So we can navigate through to some degree, but, if, you know, Europe and emerging economies are in recession, and, you know, the dollar is going skyward and our exports are weakening and we're sucking in a lot of imports, which we've been doing, that makes it very difficult for us to avoid a recession as well. The other thing I just add to the mix, I don't know if I mentioned this, but, you know, it's not only about oil and natural gas. you know, it's about refining capacity and gasoline and diesel and jet fuel. And refining capacity is paper thin. We just don't have, we're running at 100%. So if anything that disrupts that, you know, oil prices may not go up, but gas prices, jet fuel prices, diesel prices may. And now that will do this, that'll do the same damage, you know, to our economy. So something else to worry about.
Oh, good. Something else
to worry
about.
I have a lot to worry about.
Well, Donna's already got a list.
You have
a list. I did ask. We haven't even got through hurricane season, so there's that to worry about with refining capacity.
I have one more question about the housing market for you, because I know you focus on that quite a bit. I wanted to ask you how high you think rates can go.
Well, I think we're seeing the high point in rates right now. In a well-functioning economy, when I say that, an economy that is at full employment, inflation at target, growing at its potential, fixed mortgage rates on a 30-year loan should be 5.5%, that, you know, give or take. That's where we are today, 5.5%. So I think we kind of, you know, rates will go up and down and all around depending on recession concerns, inflation worries, what the Fed is doing. But I think we're going to settle in about where we are today, give or take. And so I think the adjustment in the mortgage market in terms of rates has happened very, very quickly. And, you know, obviously that's why the market's kind of seizing up here. It's trying to adjust to these higher rates that came out of nowhere and rose very rapidly. But I think 5.5% is kind of, I'd say, my kind of rule of thumb of where rates should be long run. And that's where we're going to settle in here going forward. Again, it could go higher, you know, for lots of different reasons. It can go lower if we go into recession, but 5.5 is roughly where we're going to settle in.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Speaking of interest rates, Mark, let me squeeze one more in before we get to crazy things. But obviously, Valdana and I, and honestly, most of us here at Bloomberg are obviously market nerds, as you know. And one thing everyone's fixated on these days is the yield curve inversion. We have rates on two-year treasuries today on Wednesday, as we're recording, something like 20 basis points higher than 10-year rates. Many believe that is sort of a slam dunk precursor of a recession. Do you pay much attention to the yield curve and its predictive value as an economist?
I do. I put a lot of weight on it. So, you know, it's 20 basis points today. It's been 4 or 5 days that the 10-year has been inverted. That's not enough, if that's the end of the story, to signal to me that the economy, signaling definitely the economy is going to slow. But it's, you know, and really kind of stall, come to stall speed at some point over the next year, 6-12 months. But I don't think it's signaling yet that we're going into recession. But if we stay down 20 basis points and 25, 30, and we stay there for a few weeks, a month, then my forecast will probably change. I'll probably adopt a recession forecast for the baseline, because I think that is a very prescient indicator of future economic downturns. It does a very good job of kind of pegging things. There's a lot of intuition behind it, which we can go into, but it's not just a statistical result. There is actual intuition behind why that is such a good predictor of future recession.
Well, yeah, quickly, let's get into that real quickly, the sort of cause and effect of it. Is it just a tightening in credit conditions when, you know, the near-term rates are higher than long-term rates?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way of thinking about it. I mean, the credit is the mother's milk of economic activity. Too much credit you got a problem. You get the financial crisis. Not enough credit, you seize up kind of the period after the financial crisis. You need a steady flow of credit to businesses and households to keep the economy moving forward. And if the yield curve inverts, that means the financial system can't make money, or it's hard to make money, right? Because banks and other financial institutions fund themselves with short-term money. They take that, they lend it long and get that higher interest rate. They benefit from that net interest margin or that spread. So when the yield curve inverts, they can't do that. Their margin is gone, and therefore they're less likely to extend credit. And that causes the economy, businesses, households to kind of slow up their activity and lays the foundation for recession. The other way is more of a signaling intuition, and that is just bond investors, right? So bond investors, they have a view of what the Fed's going to do. And in this environment, the Fed's been crystal clear what it's going to do. So no ambiguity. That is reflected in the two-year yield. And right now they're saying, I'm going to jack up interest rates very aggressively. And you can see that in the higher two-year yield. And then the bond investors say, oh, well, that's definitely going to slow the economy, push us into recession, bring inflation down. Therefore, I think I'm going to do well buying a longer-term bond, like a 10-year bond. And so that drives down the 10-year yield. So if it gets inverted, that reflects both the bond investors' expectation of what the Fed's going to do and what they think is that's all going to do to the economy going forward. And and bond investors are, this is folks that put their money where their mouth is, right? So they're really thinking about these things. And so I think, we should pay attention to what they're saying.
Great stuff, Mark. Really, really appreciate it. And one thing we pay attention to around here, Vildana, is, do you know where I'm going?
The craziest things in the market.
Am I that predictable? Things? Craziest.
Is
yes.
it craziest? Yes. I remember I used to call it weirdest for such a long time.
Yeah, you'd think after 100 or so podcasts, you'd get it right by now. But
yeah, I still can't. Yeah. Can't differentiate.
I've got a good one in honor of Mark Zandi of Moody's.
I'll go first.
You go mine first, though.
Oh, you guys come up with one every week?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You must spend like a day trying to figure this out.
Actually, this one was easy for me because it was just the most interesting story to me. It's not actually so much markets related, but close enough. So I'm going to give myself a pass. But it's a Bloomberg story called Eat the Rich Popsicles Draw NYC Crowd Opining on Musk Twitter. So there's an ice cream truck in New York City, and this guy is selling popsicles of faces of Elon Musk, Jack Ma, Bill Gates, like all these people. The whole stunt is called Eat the Rich. And I guess people gathered, bought ice cream pops. The only thing is, each popsicle is $10.
$10.
I guess there's inflation in ice cream too.
That ice cream truck driver is going to get rich.
$10.
I wouldn't want to eat an Elon Musk face popsicle.
Actually, the faces. Maybe we can tweet out a picture or something. Some of the faces were like spot on. You can tell it's Bill Gates.
Wow.
It has little glasses.
$10 for a Bill Gates popsicle. It'd have to be a hot day for me to shuck out $10. How about you, Mark? You see anything crazy this week?
Well, I'm going to go back to my home in Vero. This is crazy to me. I don't know. And I think it's symptomatic of the craziness. According to Zillow, and I think we all look at Zillow, I tend to look at Zillow when prices are going up and they're going down. But I have been looking a lot in the last couple of years because according to Zillow, my home in Vero has literally doubled in price.
Wow.
In two years. Now,
Congratulations.
Talk about crazy.
Now, how accurate do you think Zillow is these days? Back in the day, I feel like it was pretty off, but it's gotten better, do you think?
I don't think that's what my home's going to transact at that price, but I think it's in the ballpark, right? Because you get transaction level data, you can do.
They're just pulled in comps of models. Similar.
Yeah, you can do a pretty good job with the transactions that have actually occurred. So I think it's reasonably accurate, but nonetheless, that's not, I don't. You know, I'm not expecting that I can sell that house at that price. That is crazy.
Sell now, I say.
Sell now.
That's why I said
congratulations. No, I love that home. I'm not selling, but yeah.
Well, all right. My crazy thing is actually someone's famous home. I don't even know how to say that.
I don't know.
I'm tongue twisted here.
Famous person's home.
Famous person's home. First, Vildana, I have to ask you: do you know the name of Elvis Presley's home in Tennessee, Mark?
No,
I know
come
you know
on.
It.
What is it?
Oh wait.
Shoot, I should have watched the movie the other day.
I'll give you a hint. It was also a great Paul Simon album in the 80s.
Yeah, right. I know.
Oh,
I'm getting too old.
Dream something.
You guys are both disappointing. Graceland.
Graceland.
Right. Oh, yeah. Graceland, right.
Now, what I did not know about Graceland, and Mark, maybe you knew this at Moody's. I know you guys are heavy into the municipal bond market. There are muni bonds attached to Graceland. The city of Memphis and the county of Shelby, Tennessee, have issued muni bonds to sort of restore and make improvements to it. Fortunately, they defaulted, the muni bonds on Elvis's homes defaulted. So I talk about rock and roll being dead. I think that's, you know, that's your biggest sign right now.
Did Moody's rate those bonds?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. I would imagine they did. I don't know. I'll have to look into that.
I'm very, very curious.
This is all based on a column by our own muni expert, Joe Mysak, who is, one of the best columnists on this space around.
That's a good one.
I don't think he got into any of the ratings on him. But, Mark, as you may or may not know, I like to turn this part into
a game
of Price is Right. So Mysak in his column says he uses the yearly attendance of Graceland as sort of a benchmark for other muni bonds around the country that are based on some sort of attraction like this, whether, you know, a county wants to open a museum or something like that, and they're selling muni bonds to
Dollywood, maybe
to purchase it. I can't imagine Dolly has a muni attached to it. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I think that's all Dolly's money that went into that. But so his line of thinking is if some county somewhere is floating a muni bond based on the prospect of attendance at a museum or whatever the attraction is, Graceland's his sort of benchmark.
Okay.
If they're expecting to do better than Graceland in its yearly attendance, he's skeptical. If they're somewhere below it, he sort of hears them out. So the game show today is, what do you think the yearly attendance at Graceland was in 2019,
pre-pandemic.
Last year before the pandemic.
We can ask my wife. She's lurking in the shadows. Over here. I have no idea why.
Is she an Elvis fan?
Are you an Elvis fan?
My dad was.
Oh, her dad was. Her dad was.
All right. Time for a guess for you. We'll allow a spousal guess.
So Graceland attendance in 2019.
Yeah. Full year attendance.
Should I go first or Mark, would you like to go first? I'm very bad at guessing this, so I'm going to go with... I'm guessing this number is much higher than I would ever imagine.
I'm keeping a poker face. I'm not going to tell you.
I'll go with 15 million.
15 million?
15 million.
Oh my gosh, is that too high? Can I revise?
That sounds like a lot of people chasing through. How many square foot is Graceland?
Oh my gosh. Can I revise?
Mark could be playing you here.
I could be just playing with you.
Yeah, he could be just trying to psych
out.
Yeah.
All right,
we'll allow one revision.
Okay, 2 million.
2 million. Mark, what's your guess? Remember, Price is Right rules are in effect. What's your guess for the yearly attendance at Graceland in 2019?
I don't like this whole Price is Right thing, but I'll take a guess. I'll say 300,000.
300,000. 534,488 for the year of 2019. So I think
who wins?
I think Mark wins.
I think you win.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just multiplied 1,000 times the number of days in the year, take a few vacation days. Because how many people can actually go through a home in one day?
15 million, I think.
Okay. Valdana's. Okay,
I got to see the foot traffic at Valdana's place sometimes.
Well, my wife, she's looking back there. Yeah, you can see her.
I just figured it's some absurd number because the stakes are so high if this is the benchmark.
Well, right. But his point is that, you know, if you think you can beat Graceland numbers of 500,000 a year, you know.
Six Flags not.
What is your attraction to... Well, Six Flags, you know, I don't think the Township of Jackson, New Jersey has a muni bond attached to Six Flags.
No, but I was
wrong.
Just thinking
if I'm wrong about that.
I was just thinking about visitors. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he's...
Madonna, just give it up. You're never going to get your...
I lost this one. I did really well the last couple of weeks, though.
Yeah.
So. That's fine.
If it had been $15 million, I think they wouldn't have defaulted on their bonds, maybe.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah.
So. You never know. All right, I'll give it up.
I'll look up Moody's rating on that one, Mark. I don't know. Joe would have made some hay out of it if you guys got that one wrong. So I'm guessing you maybe it went unrated. I don't know.
That was a good one, though.
Yeah, very good.
The King, Elvis, but I am disappointed you couldn't remember Graceland.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've forgotten more important things. But,
I'm a millennial.
Yeah, you get a pass, I guess. Yeah. You get a pass. All right. With that said, I think that is all the time we have. Mark Zandi of Moody, such a pleasure to hear your thoughts, especially with this important week of CPI and whatever comes next. We're sure you'll be 100% right with all your predictions today.
50% right. That's my goal, Mike.
That's
yeah, I appreciate it. I really thank you so much for the opportunity. It was very, very enjoyable.
Great.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.